This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Early voting in Indiana starts tomorrow for the upcoming election. Today and tomorrow, we're diving into the race for governor by listening to extended interviews with three gubernatorial candidates, incumbent Republican Eric Holcomb, Democrat Woody Myers, and Libertarian candidate Donald Rainwater. What you'll hear from each interview is unedited, but we did have to cut them down a little bit to fit in the show. We're joined now by Brandon Smith, the State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, who conducted these interviews. Brandon, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, well, let's start by talking about the pandemic factor here, and I fully realize we could spend the entire hour talking about this, but yeah. Let's hit on the big points to start with. What are a few ways these campaigns are different this year?
Well, for one thing, it's literally how they're campaigning. You know, gone are the more traditional, you know, rallies and door-to-door, you know, knocking on doors and fundraising dinners like we usually see, or house parties where you get a bunch of people in one room to talk to the candidate. We don't see a lot of that, certainly not in the gubernatorial race. Governor Eric Holcomb has not been out and around the state nearly as much as he normally would, even in a non-election year. Democrat Woody Myers, same deal. It's been replaced a lot by Zoom calls and meetings like that, where you're having some one-on-one or, you know, one-on-three or two or whatever contacts. But it's not a real, you know, I've talked to a political scientist, Andrew Downs, up at Purdue Fort Wayne about this, and he said it's not really a true replacement, that direct voter contact in person is the best way to campaign for offices like these. And you can't really replicate that with Zoom or you know, video conferencing or things like that. He said the one difference that might help a candidate, especially in a statewide race where you're everywhere is your constituency in the state, is that unlike door-to-door campaigning or house parties or things like that, Zoom or video conferencing does allow you to, you know, hit voters one after the other, after the other, after the other, all over the state. So you can do maybe more volume than you would in normal campaigning, which does help you get a little closer perhaps to making up for that lack of direct contact, but it's not the same.
Let's spend a few minutes on each of the three candidates, starting with Democrat Woody Myers. Indiana is, I mean, it's pretty reliably Republican, but Myers has a few things going for him that really fit into the times. What are they?
They are. It's a couple big things. One, he is a medical doctor and a former Indiana State Health Commissioner in a year when a global pandemic has dominated the headlines and the discussion and the debate and all of our lives, seemingly. He is also the first black person to run for governor on a major party's ticket in this state's history. In a year when racial inequity and protests over police violence against people of color, and particularly the black community, have dominated a lot of headlines and discussion and debate this summer. So he has not just a compelling profile in a normal year, which he does, but I mean, tailor-made. For the exact year we are talking about, the exact campaign he is in. And yet, I don't see a lot of people thinking he's gained a lot of traction around the state, to be quite frank.
How is this campaign doing financially, though, along those lines?
Not well. Not well. I mean, you're always going to – a challenger is almost always going to trail an incumbent. Eric Holcomb has the benefit of, you know, more than 4 years or about 4 years of fundraising compared to Woody Myers, who got into this race last summer. So that's always going to be – you're always going to be at a disadvantage there. You're going to be at a disadvantage, generally speaking, when you're a Democrat in Indiana running statewide versus a Republican running statewide. But – It's not close. We're talking about Governor Holcomb having millions, more, over 7 million in the bank, in his campaign war chest in the last reports we saw, and Woody Myers couldn't break 100,000 in the bank. So that starts to put you at a real disadvantage in terms of what you're able to do, whether you're able to not be able to get on TV with ads the way we've seen Governor Holcomb have multiple ads now for a couple months. It helps you. It doesn't help you with getting the ground game out and things like that. So it's a real problem. I mean, a disadvantage, sure. that kind of disadvantage, that starts to have real world consequences.
Let's talk about some of the issues. The platform, I mean, challengers' favorite things to do are attack incumbents. But aside from that, is there anything that Woody Myers is saying that isn't really a huge part of the conversation platform-wise right now, other than critiquing Governor Holcomb's performance?
Oh, sure. He's put out several agendas on various issues that I would say aren't at the top of the conversation list, and certainly not really something that Governor Holcomb is talking about. His agenda for African Americans, his agenda for women, his agenda for healthcare, things like that. Governor Holcomb isn't talking specifically about any of those individual issues as much as he is talking about his overall job performance. And, you know, Governor Holcomb's top messages, besides COVID, of course, are things like jobs and the economy. It's what Republicans have been resting their hats on in this state for quite some time. And not to say that Woody Myers has ignored that, but his agenda has gone so much farther than all of that. But again, I think a lot he's struggling to get that attention that Governor Holcomb just naturally gets in part because he's the incumbent governor.
It seems like the pandemic is a bit of a shot in the arm for Woody Myers' campaign, given that he's a medical doctor and former state health commissioner. But might his campaign be doing better if we weren't in the middle of a pandemic so he could connect with voters and get his name out there a little bit more?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because it's kind of a one step forward, one step back problem for him. On the one hand, because COVID is at the forefront of so much of the conversation and what voters are thinking about as it relates to so many issues in their lives, he has this great compelling story that he can share, because when he speaks about COVID and the state's response, it comes with, it's not just any, you know, any challenger to Governor Holcomb or an incumbent talking about it. It's a guy who literally has expertise in this issue. He's not just a medical doctor. He is the former Indiana State Health Commissioner. You know, he was a lead physician for the chief medical officer for Anthem, an insurance, you know, the insurance giant. So yeah, on the one hand, he has this great story to tell around this issue that everybody is talking about. But on the other hand, yeah, like we've talked about, he can't get around the state and meet voters in person the way he would in a normal election year and get his name out there in that way. He also, you could argue, might not be having some of the fundraising issues that he's been having if he could do more of those fundraising events across the state that he would normally be able to do, and if people weren't watching their pocketbooks a little closer right now for obvious reasons, as the economy has taken a turn in the wrong direction around COVID. So it's really a push and pull for him. COVID has given him a really compelling story to tell, but it has also made campaigning that much harder. And it's made it harder for Eric Holcomb, too. But when you have all of Eric Holcomb's advantages, being an incumbent, being a Republican, having all of this money to start with, it doesn't hurt him as much.
OK, let's talk about Libertarian candidate Donald Rainwater. In what ways could he be a factor in this year's election?
Yeah, this is an interesting one, because for the most part, Libertarian gubernatorial candidates in Indiana haven't made much of a difference in these races. They haven't broken like 4% support really ever, going back certainly three decades as they've been on the ballot. And generally, it's for those three decades, it's been Democrat, Republican, Libertarian on the ballot and nobody else, in part because of the way the state system is set up for third party access to the ballot. Mm. But this year is different in so many ways, and one of them is that the Libertarian could have a real shot at influencing this race. I don't think there's many people who think the Libertarian can win the race, but winning the race and having an impact are two different things. First of all, we did see a poll a few weeks ago that suggested that the Libertarian had 24% support. I don't know a lot of people in any party who think that poll is all that accurate. But it does raise the question of, what if the Libertarian starts to get to 15 or 20%, gets above 10%? Well, some of it depends on where those votes are coming from. If those are votes that traditionally would have gone to Eric Holcomb, the Republican, Well, now you're talking about a Democrat being able to win, or a challenger being able to win this race, not with 49, 50% of the vote, but only with 40% of the vote. And a Democrat can absolutely get to 40% of the vote in this state. I mean, the last two candidates for Indiana governor who were Democrats, who was the same person, former House Speaker John Gregg, running against Pence in 12 and Holcomb in 16, he got a heck of a lot more than 40%. He was very, very close to both of those candidates. Now, I'm not sure a lot of people think Woody Myers can replicate those results, because Gregg was able to do a lot more traditional campaigning and had a lot more money. But if he can get to 40%, which is incredibly doable, and I would expect him to reach, I think a lot of people would expect him to reach, or at least get close to, and Donald Rainwater, the Libertarian, is getting 15 or 20% of the vote and taking those votes generally away from Eric Holcomb, well, now you're talking about a real race. And so it'll be really interesting to see what sort of impact Donald Rainwater has at the polls. Because the other problem there is, I talked to Andy Downs, the political scientist, is he talked about the sort of viability factor, which is when voters go into the polling booth or fill out their ballot, there are some for whom a vote for a third party candidate, in this case a Libertarian, is their core belief. They are Libertarians, or they feel themselves aligned with the Libertarian candidate, and so that's who they want to vote for, period. And there are some voters for whom a vote for the Libertarian is a protest vote of sorts. It's, boy, I really don't like what Eric Holcomb is doing, but I'm not a Democrat. I don't align myself with the Democratic Party or the Democratic candidate. I can't vote for them. So I'm going to vote for this candidate, the Libertarian. I can see myself agreeing with him. I'm going to do that. That doesn't happen as often. So you have to, as a third party candidate, you have to, what Andy Downs talked about was, you have to overcome that sort of viability question, which is, do enough people feel like they're not throwing their vote away, which is a crass way of thinking about anyone casting their vote for anyone, but do enough people think that they're not throwing their vote away by casting their vote for this third party candidate? If he can get enough people to think that, then we're talking about a really interesting election.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about the three candidates for governor in Indiana. And when we come back, we'll talk a little more about Libertarian challenger Donald Rainwater and about incumbent Governor Eric Holcomb and his chances for re-election. And we'll hear from the governor himself this hour in the first of three interviews with each of the candidates. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds. This is All In. All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about the candidates for Indiana governor, the incumbent Republican Eric Holcomb, Democratic candidate Woody Myers, and Libertarian candidate Donald Rainwater. We'll be playing extended interviews with each candidate during today and tomorrow's shows. And coming up, we will hear from Governor Eric Holcomb. And to help us get some context, we are joined by Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, who conducted these interviews. And we were talking before the break about Libertarian challenger Donald Rainwater. And what has Rainwater said about Holcomb's response to the pandemic?
Yeah, both Democrat Dr. Woody Myers and Donald Rainwater have both criticized Governor Holcomb's response to COVID-19, but from very different angles. Mm-hmm. Woody Myers wants Eric Holcomb to do a lot more, and Donald Rainwater thinks Eric Holcomb should do a lot less, which aligns with the Libertarian view of government, which is as little government as possible in order to fulfill some basic needs of people's lives and society. So I asked him, and you'll hear this when you hear the Donald Rainwater interview, I asked him multiple times about the idea of the role of government in addressing the pandemic. And he keeps coming back to the idea that the government's role is to provide people with information. And that's pretty much it in a lot of ways. There are some caveats to that in terms of, for instance, how the state is spending its federal COVID relief dollars. Donald Rainwater has some ideas about that. But in general, he believes that the government's job in this case is to provide people with the best information about the disease and how they should approach it, but then let people make decisions for themselves as to how they are personally going to address the pandemic. But one thing that Donald Rainwater is extremely critical of, and that I know a lot of members of Holcomb's party, particularly in the legislature, are very angry about, is his statewide mask order. Now, it's not a mandate, despite what Governor Holcomb and others might claim, because it doesn't actually, there's no enforcement, so that doesn't actually require you to wear a mask in that sense. But it is an order, a suggestion, I suppose, a strongly worded suggestion from the governor's office to wear a mask when in public. And a lot of conservatives really have a problem with the government telling them what to do in that sense. People point to, well, how is that any different than, you know, the law about wearing your seatbelt? It's not. But I know a lot of conservatives in the General Assembly who still don't think we should have a seatbelt law. So.
Well, let's expand on that a little more, and let's kind of shift the focus to Holcomb and his campaign. I mean, if COVID and the governor's race hadn't happened in the same year, do you think that Holcomb would be handling it much differently given these political pressures?
I do not, for the most part. There is a there are people who believe that the governor's most recent move on COVID-19, which was a couple weeks ago, he basically lifted almost all of the statewide restrictions on COVID-19, with the exception of the mask order. Gone are the capacity limits in retail establishments, bars and restaurants, etc. Generally, there's really not a lot of limits on the number of people who can gather at any one event, although if you have 500 or more people, you have to get approval from your local health department. But beyond that, there are no limits. So he's almost opened everything up in that sense, other than the mask order. And there are a lot of people who think that Indiana was honestly not at a place where we should be doing that, looking at our COVID-19 data, particularly as since he made that order, the numbers have started to go in the wrong direction again, although not related to that order, because we haven't seen any sort of impact from stage five of the reopening plan, as it's called. There are people who think that the timing of that is not coincidental. That is, he's looking down the barrel of Election Day and people casting their votes, that he doesn't, that he wants to minimize the people who are upset at him. I don't know that that's true, but I know a lot of people think that. Other than that, no, I don't think he's, any of his decision making has been driven by the election. If this were happening in 2017 after he'd just been elected, I suspect he would have made a lot of the same decisions.
In a lot of ways, the governor's job is even busier now than it usually is. At least it seems that way to us.
I think so. It does look that way. Yeah.
It certainly does. Has he even had much time to campaign?
He hasn't, although he has the benefit of, very early on in the pandemic, he was on television and radio and in newspapers every single day because he was having those daily press conferences about the pandemic. Eventually, as he started to open up things and lift restrictions, it went to, you know, three times a week, then two times a week, then once a week. And now he's not doing them anymore. Instead, just his state health commissioner and another member of the State Department of Health will be conducting these once a week press conferences to talk about sort of the medical side of COVID-19 and the state's response, whereas we won't see the governor in that sense. So the expectation for at least reporters is that Governor Holcomb is going to be out and about at places and events a little more so that we will still have access to him to talk to him. But that's another thing that I think people are kind of questioning him on, is like, well, the pandemic isn't over. Our numbers are starting to go back in the wrong direction. And yet he's not going to be out there talking to Hoosiers about that. But at the same time, if you're a Democrat, this was free. I mean, this was basically, you know, free media for Eric Holcomb, the entire, almost the, you know, last seven, eight months. So in that sense, I would imagine you might be happy that he's not on your TV or radio anymore.
Let's talk about other factors. Let's talk, I guess, a little more about fundraising. There's another statewide race that's throwing another variable into this and getting a lot of attention from donors. What is it?
It's the race for attorney general. And I think you have to talk about that when you're talking about the governor's race. If I'm a person in the state of Indiana, if I'm a Hoosier who typically gives to campaigns, and I'm looking at, you know, my dollars, if I'm the sort of person who can't spread your dollars everywhere, if I'm looking at a statewide race to support, there's this attorney general's race, which is an open seat because incumbent Curtis Hill, a Republican, lost his bid for reelection at the state Republican Party convention, and that's because throughout his term in office, he has been plagued by a sexual misconduct scandal in which the state Supreme Court suspended his law license because it said he committed criminal battery against four women a few years ago. That's why he's not the Republican candidate, and that's why there was a lot more attention being paid to the attorney general's race than there would in a normal year. That is generally considered in presidential election years what we call a baseline race in Indiana, which means the candidates don't matter as much. It's if you're a Republican, you cast your vote for a Republican. If you're a Democrat, you cast your vote for a Democrat. And we get a pretty good idea of where everybody sits, regardless of the issues or the people involved in the race. That is not the case this year because so much more light was shown on the attorney general's office and the attorney general's race. And so you have Jonathan Weinzappel, former Evansville mayor, former state representative, former chancellor of Ivy Tech, facing off against former congressman and secretary of state Todd Rokita, the Republican. This one, I think a lot of people expect to be a lot closer. And Jonathan Weinzappel has done much better than a typical Democratic candidate for AG in raising money. So that might be another thing that's contributing to Woody Myers' fundraising struggles. Because if I'm looking to give money to a Democratic candidate, I might go for the one whose race seems a lot more winnable, which this year happens to be Attorney General and Jonathan Weinzappel.
We've been joined by State House reporter Brandon Smith talking about the governor's race in Indiana. Thanks, Brandon.
Thank you.
But you haven't heard the last of him this hour. He sat down with all three candidates. You'll hear the Democratic and Libertarian challengers tomorrow, but you'll hear his interview with incumbent Governor Eric Holcomb right now.
Well, Governor, thanks so much for sitting down. I want to start with the thing that's dominated all of our lives for the last 6 months, which I'm sure you can guess is COVID-19.
Yes.
Looking back over the last 6 months then, is there any changes you would make? What would you change about the state's response to the pandemic?
Well, I certainly wouldn't change how proud I am of the way that three different sectors all came together with in a real quickness and focus. And that is the nonprofit sector, the private sector, and the government sectors. And I'm not just talking about the state government. I'm talking about local governments as well. And to think where we are right now after month after month after month, especially when you look around the world at different cases. Look at the UK today, and it's doubling about every 7 days cases. In Indiana, we currently find ourselves, you know, with a spread rate of under one, about 0.94, and our positivity rate, 7-day positivity rate is, as of today, 4.1%. With all tests considered. And so we're in a place where we can continue to manage our way through this. And again, it's because people got very organized very quickly. We had an influenza, you know, playbook that we could deploy, but this was it's a global pandemic, and it was on a scale and the size and scale and the pace of the infectious rate was one like we haven't seen in since 1918. Right. So proud of the team, proud of the areas of expertise, proud of the cross-training that's occurred. I think that's what's kind of separated us. We were informed by each sector within each sector. And so, you know, we didn't ever shut down completely. A lot of people say you shut down. Well, I mean, there was a lot of business going on. And so when you balance the lives first and foremost, safety first, and the livelihoods, I mean, think about, could have been a couple of weeks ago, we would have been doing this interview and we were looking at, you know, adjusted up a 17.5% unemployment rate. We're now at 6.4, lower than every state that we touch, lower than the national average, higher labor participation rate. So we're proving you can go back to school. We're proving you can go back to work. As was announced last Wednesday, our freight travel on our roads is up as well. And so proud of the real team effort that it took to get us to this point. Now, having said that, you know, we're going to have to remain vigilant. We're going to have to remain on our toes. And we can't kind of sit back and say, okay, we're through the worst of it, because that could, as the UK is experiencing and other places around the world, you let your guard down and it slips away from you and you're right back to where you started.
So I wanted to ask about that specifically, which is you've been in this stage 4.5 where everything's kind of open for the most part.
Yeah.
There are a few capacity limits that still remain on various venues. Until we have a vaccine that's widely available, is that just kind of where Indiana needs to be?
No, we're continuing to make progress. And
but if you make progress and then undo all that, doesn't it just go right back?
Well, no, because you know we were at stage 1, 2, 3, 4, 4.5. We were continuing to open up and ease some of the restrictions, and capacity levels will change. So you can change things, but what you can't change is this. I mean, you can't change what's working. That's not to say that if properly physically distanced, if masked up, if you're sick, stay home. You know, I learned in probably the first grade to cover my cough. That was for a good reason. So those kind of things don't change. We need to do all that we can to not just mitigate, but to slow the spread so, again, our healthcare network can handle the cases that truly need the attention that they need. So we'll look at this on a county by county and a statewide basis in real time, and let the data drive the decisions that we make. And we'll have some updates this Wednesday coming up on where we go from here.
With the restrictions, with the mask order, there have been members of your party, particularly I think about some in the legislature, who've been really unhappy with the decisions you've made. When they come back into session, presumably in January, presumably they will have some things to say about that legislatively. But beyond just what they might do about the powers that the governor's office has, do you have to repair those relationships in order to get any sort of legislation passed the next year, 2, 3, 4 years of your term, if you get reelected?
Well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But look, my door is open. I'm in constant conversations with members in the General Assembly, and I'm in constant conversations with, seemingly it feels, about 6.7 million Hoosiers. And I'm constantly seeking more input, not less. You know, my job, what I signed up for, was to make some decisions, especially during times of an emergency. And we'll continue to do that. And they will be informed decisions. And we will let science and doctors, epidemiologists, make those recommendations to us. And then the buck stops at my desk. But, of course, I will continue to work with. And, look, Brandon, I've been around long enough, going back to 2005, where there are bumps in the road. But that doesn't mean relationships are gone. It just means that you need to sit down, work on things that you can agree on, share information back and forth. We're not going to agree on 100%. I wish we weren't in this situation as well. But I've said, if wishes were horses, we all ride away. This is not the reality that we find ourselves in right now. If it wasn't working, if these decisions weren't working, I'd be the first to say, let's try something else, right? I mean, but the fact of the matter is, a month ago, if we were having this conversation, we were in a different situation. So these actions have benefited, most importantly, lives of our neighbors.
There's been criticism of the way you've spent the CARES Act money. We're still sitting on a lot of it. Even beyond what we've literally spent, also even allocated. What we say we want to spend on. And some of that comes from differing guidance from the administration. But there's things we know we can spend money on because you already have, and you could spend more. Why are we sitting on so much of that money?
Well, we're being fiscally prudent about when we actually not just, as you point out, allocate, but actually spend. We're going to spend this, the allocation that we've been given through the CARES dollars from our federal partners. We won't leave money sitting on the table. But look, I took equal criticism for not spending down the rainy day fund and not spending down our reserves. And folks said it was raining then. Thank goodness that we had those reserves to be able to bridge our way to the other side. And we're looking at where are the needs right now. And so when you look at what's working, when you look at our, whether it be evictions, I mean, we're monitoring, we're processing right now. And if there is a greater need, I suspect there will be. If there's a greater need, fortunately, we will not have spent that money. We will be able to allocate and devote it to that area of need. Workforce training programs, wildly successful. We've had tens of thousands of Hoosiers from the beginning of Next Level Jobs, those two twin programs for employers and employees. But we then put $37 million more dollars into it and said, Hoosiers, if you'll put the skin in the game, if you'll put the time in the game, we'll pay for it to get that credential or certificate. We're going through that. And so we want to make sure that we know that the jobs are there. We know that people are hiring. And those certificates are getting people at an average of over $20 an hour. So we need to do more of what's working and address those needs. To your point, it's September right now. We have the fourth quarter to go. Fortunately, our numbers are trending in the right direction. What we don't want to happen is to get in the fourth quarter and say, we need more money for testing or tracing, these things that really help us manage this. Because as we are going out to our local counties, 92 of them, and saying, hey, we'll help you financially do more testing for the next 2 years, not the next quarter, but for the next 2 years, this responsible way of allocating the dollars is what's going to, again, put us in the driver's seat. And you see that by the attention from outside our state borders saying, we want to go to a place of certainty, of that's responsible, of predictability. That's why, look, to put this in context, not to just make this about jobs or an infomercial for the IEDC, but we've already passed the new job commitment record level in 2016 this year, and it's September. We have a fourth quarter to go. We've done $3.2 billion of new CapEx investment in the state of Indiana this year during a global pandemic. So we're not just getting back on track. We're on track. What we have to do is make sure that we responsibly see our way through this in its entirety, and that will require us making kind of weekly, monthly decisions in terms of those precious CARES Act dollars that we have at our disposal right now.
And we will be back after a quick break. We're listening to an extended interview today with Governor Eric Holcomb as we hear from each of the three gubernatorial candidates today and tomorrow. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Before we get back to the show, I wanted to let you know that you can now interact with us in a new way. Download the All In Vox Pop app, wherever you get apps. With it, you can send us a high-quality audio file with a comment or question when we're on with a live panel, so it's literally the best way to get your voice heard on the show. Just search All In Vox Pop wherever you get apps. Back now to an extended interview with Governor Eric Holcomb as we feature each of the three gubernatorial candidates during our shows today and tomorrow. Governor Holcomb sat down with Brandon Smith, our statehouse reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. What you'll hear is unedited, but we did have to cut these interviews down a little bit for time.
On to the other thing that's dominated headlines the last few months, which is racial inequity protests around police shootings of black men and women and things like that. Mm-hmm. You announced a series of steps that you want to see the state government take, as well as potentially into the future on this issue. But when I looked at, for instance, reaction from the Black Caucus, a lot of it was skepticism. It wasn't, these are terrible ideas. It was, well, okay, but let's see. Mm-hmm. Do people in Indiana, do Hoosiers of color in particular, have reason to be skeptical that things will change?
Well, maybe to date, but hopefully not going forward because of the actions that we're taking and going to continue to take. For me, this is near and dear to my heart. It's how I was raised. It's the diverse group of friends that I have. I felt like I was very close to this issue, and this topic had never come up on a very personal basis with me. That's not to say that I was ignorant in terms of access and awareness of different programs. That's why we've been leaning into this. But after Mr. Floyd's death, it was crystallized in my mind that we have to do something different than just have those programs out there. And if there are barriers in my house, in the state government, then we need to make sure that we're removing those barriers and getting rid of those hurdles. And I'm pleased to say that, you know, we worked with the Indiana Black Expo to make sure that we were getting the word out in terms of that awareness and access to different programs. And it's working, by the way. And more people are getting skilled up. More black minority-owned businesses are using these resources. And so with those reports that will come out that we'll be very transparent about on our portal, with the following up on the recommendations when we look at the curriculum at ILEA, we're in the process of narrowing that down to the entity that will come in and then make that evaluation and then put forward the recommendations. We'll take action, and we'll be able to share that, and I hope that will give Hoosiers across the board, because believe me, I would ask, I've talked to a lot of different entities and a lot of different organizations over the last few months, not just the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus, but a lot of Hoosiers across the spectrum in a lot of different sectors. And what it comes down to in my mind is empowerment. How are we going to empower people to better determine their own destinies? And that comes down to a lot of teamwork out there across the whole state of Indiana. And again, I'm looking forward to the results that will come from not just appointing a new CEIOO, Equity and Inclusion Officer, an Opportunity Officer, but what they will do across the board in the state government. And I hope, by the way, that becomes a model for other entities inside the state of Indiana. So when we're doing an analysis on hiring or training or procurement or workforce training programs, I hope the nonprofit and the private sector out there will look at it and say, what's my C-suite look like? What's my procurement look like? What are my training programs? What do they look like? And that will truly raise all of our games. And there are people out there that are doing a good job of this right now. We want to emulate those practices. And what it often comes down to in my mind as I did the evaluation is, again, empowerment, but taking inventory of the results in each agency.
When you announced those steps you're taking, there was some criticism because you didn't announce a ban on chokeholds or no-knock warrants that a lot of people have called for. But you talked about the review of training at the State Police Academy that is going on. But both you and Superintendent Carter stressed that this outside third-party review will be from an expert group made up of former law enforcement. But is any sort of review of those policies going to be as effective if you're not also taking into account what the communities of color are saying? So shouldn't there be community leader involvement?
Yeah, that'll be part of it, and it is. And by the way, I mean, if you think about this in terms of those third-party evaluations, that's when you get the kind of unvarnished truth. That's when people tell you exactly in their areas of expertise what has worked and what has not worked. And so, of course, we know of where we live. And of course, the citizens of Indiana will judge us on our actions, and they'll be able to see what those recommendations are.
One more thing that's in the headlines as of this week now, the death of Justice Ginsburg has changed the conversation in the election around the future of reproductive rights because of a lot of people thinking that that could change now with the balance shifting at the court. So I wanted to ask you, when it comes to here at the state level, about that issue, which is specifically that there's been a total abortion ban legislation filed for years now in the General Assembly. And the line from leaders has always been, well, there's no chance that would have success at the high court. There's no reason for Indiana to push forward on that. That could be changing here pretty soon as the balance of the court shifts significantly more into the conservative. At least that's the hope of many, I think, in leadership in the Republican Party. So, directly, if a total abortion ban gets to your desk, do you sign it?
Well, I've always believed that I don't, for my own personal reasons, I don't have the authority to determine to take innocent life. I have an exception, but that's, I'll leave to the doctor to decide from a medical standpoint in terms of the life of the mother. And You just listed on a very controversial, hot-button subject the word if a few times. And so if I'm back, I will review what that legislation that comes to my desk is. Obviously, I've shared with members of both parties where I am. I've been open about that, very transparent. I just don't believe I have that authority. That is what makes me, if you were using labels, pro-life, proud to be. Having said that, we'll see what legislation comes down, because you're talking about replacing a Supreme Court justice, which obviously, by the way, could or could not have an effect on that.
But I just want to clarify something you said here. So in terms of this job interview you're doing with the people of Indiana, in terms of they, a lot of people want to know where you stand on this on both sides of the issue.
I'm a pro-life governor. My actions have supported that, and I am who I have always said I am on that issue.
And I just want to clarify, you so that I make sure I understand.
Sure.
You believe that abortion should be banned with the exception of cases where the abortion would save the life of the mother.
Yeah, and I'll leave that to the doctor to decide.
Okay. I want to talk about education. Mm-hmm. Always an important issue for a gubernatorial campaign, but more important perhaps than ever because we no longer have an elected state. We will no longer have an elected state superintendent. Yep. So when it comes to that decision, the first ever appointment for a state superintendent that you might have if you're reelected, mm-hmm. what are the qualifications? What are you looking for in that person?
Well, obviously that they meet all the criteria of the statute first and foremost, so that they have a thorough understanding of what they're getting themselves into. They're fluent in the area of education from, you know, the whole complete pathway of a student's life. So they have that experience and they meet the criteria of the statute. I've also said very, when this topic has come up, just personally, as people say, what are you looking for in a person? I have said, again, that's a hypothetical right now with me, but we are hearing from folks in the office, and there'll be a repository of folks who have made recommendations, but I'll review that after the election if I'm authorized actually to weigh in on this, but I'm going to be looking for someone, and this is what I've told people, you know, who's the same thing I'm looking for in every agency head, quite frankly, someone who's honest, someone who's humble, and someone who's hungry. And obviously, I get that so much of what we do, you know, in terms of as a state, is rightly prioritized in the area of education. It's over half our budget, K-12. More when you consider higher education. We've added $1.6 billion into education just since 2017. So we rightly have this as our number one priority. I want to make sure the individual that assumes that role, if I'm there, so another if, I want to make sure that person understands the whole pathway, that students are getting, they're exploring their opportunities and their options, and that they're getting engaged by the time they get that diploma. And then where does that send them, whether it's wearing the uniform, going to college 2-year or 4-year, or going right into the workforce. And so that's what I'm going to be looking for, is someone's mastery or someone's comprehension of what the whole pathway looks like and their ability then to obviously lead.
Given that,
and connect with teachers, connect with parents, connect with principals, connect with superintendents. That's what I've tried to do over these last 4 years, is make sure I'm talking to not just one entity, but all of them.
Given that public school education accounts for, it's like 93% of students in the state of Indiana, how important is it for that person to have experience as a public school teacher, yeah, or principal or superintendent? Yeah.
Well, we'll see, you know, what each individual's strengths are and when we make the ultimate decision. I want them to be, though, to answer the question, you know, directly, I want them to be fluent. I've said this also in a number of venues, I don't want there to be on-the-job training. I don't want them to have to look up what certain acronyms mean, if you catch my drift. I want them to be able to hit the ground running because, look, we're coming through. Think about this. Not only is it the first ever going to be Secretary of Education, but we're coming right on the, you know, through a pandemic when there's been a lot of upheaval and a lot of uncertainty. And I'm not pandering, but teachers and superintendents and principals and parents have done heroic work to get to this point. I want to make sure that we're contributing to confidence and to continuity in terms of this new position, and that they're seen as a partner.
Teacher pay. Teachers, the vast majority of teachers in Indiana got a raise from the last state budget, we know, from the IRB data, but it still doesn't get us to where we'd like to be because
right.
we started from behind.
That's right.
You had the Teacher Compensation Commission that was working on developing long-term solutions,
yeah,
but we haven't heard about that lately, I'm assuming because there's a pandemic on and state budgets all over the country are going to get a lot tighter in the next maybe year to few years. Is that sort of the long-term solution for really paying our teachers what they deserve,
mm-hmm,
kind of off the table in the short term because of the pandemic and the economic struggles that have come with it?
No. Certainly the pandemic had a little to do with all of the research. They've still been working, and they'll be on target to present their findings by the end of this year. Always was going to be December when they would present. And regardless of any electoral outcome, that is there for our legislative friends and the governor, everyone, the new secretary, to be able to assess going into that next session. In this example, it happens to be a budget session. So always was meant to be in December to help prepare and inform leaders to make the decisions in terms of our budget. And you're correct. I mean, 299 of our 304 school districts did pass on a teacher pay raises. And they said they would. And to their credit, you know, when we met with the urban, rural, and suburban school corporations, they said, we hear you. We understand this is a priority to the state Senate, state House, the governor. And we'll get this to teachers. So that did, to your point, it raised it up just north of 53,000 is what an average teacher in the state of Indiana, public school teacher, makes. I want it to be higher, as you point out. I've been very vocal about that. That's where this long-term, how do we sustain paying our teachers what they are worth and what we expect of them? And that's where they're looking at. And yes, COVID affected that, but it's not going to derail anything. We're looking at, they are looking at, obviously, everything under the sun in terms of how do we get more dollars more efficiently into teacher paychecks. And so I'm as eager to see their ultimate findings in December as is every legislator I know, and therefore superintendent, principal, teacher, et cetera.
This kind of gets back to the discussion we had about racial equity issues, but it obviously dovetails with schools, which is there was a legislation that didn't cross the finish line that would have required more training for school resource officers. Mm-hmm. And there was a worry that if you required more training, you would not have as many school resource officers available. But we know that communities of color experience more arrests in schools, like they experience more arrests in their communities at large.
Yeah.
Do we need, and school resource officers themselves say this training is vital for what they do, because working in a school setting is not like working in the community
yep.
setting. How important is it then to mandate that extra training to make sure that we're addressing this issue of racial equity at the same time that we're also addressing shortfalls in education?
It's very important, and it's all part of the mix of the conversation that will occur in January.
So then how do you convince lawmakers of that when they weren't willing to go along with it?
Well, you
before?
Sit down. I mean, there's lots of examples of where we agree on things or don't agree on things at the outset where we end up agreeing. And there's some things that you just don't. Like to your point about you got to the end of the wire and something didn't get across the line. If at first you don't succeed, try again. And in terms of making sure our schools are safe, we continue to devote more and more, millions of more dollars to ensure the safety of our students and make sure the protocols are there. But here's the other side of the coin. We want to make sure that, and I've been asking, I want a list of all the unfunded mandates that the state may place on a school, and I want to address each and every one of them. And some may be legit and some may not be, but I'm open-minded about that. So when we're talking about mandates, you want to be really careful, and I want to be very careful of infringing on that home rule approach to it all.
That's everything I had. Thanks so much for sitting down with me.
Thank you, Brandon.
Thanks again to Brandon Smith, our State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, for talking to us about these interviews and conducting them, of course, and we'll hear his interviews tomorrow with the governor's challengers, Democratic candidate Woody Myers and Libertarian candidate Donald Rainwater. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss a topic you care about. And, of course, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.